Oh, okay. This is Ann Alt. How's your podcaster, your blogger? And we've got a few things on the blog that can be talked about today. It's a little bit heavy on aesthetic issues, and there's a little bit something about the pandemic, and a few things about Trump. What should I do first? Should I do the art first and the Trump last? I think yesterday I did the art first and the Trump last, so let's start with Trump. Now, one thing that was really noticeable today was that Trump was tweeting up a storm. Where is the one about that? There's a short post about an Axios article about how Trump may start a digital media empire after he's president, assuming he doesn't win this time and he's out and must do something with himself. According to the scoop in Axios, Trump eyes digital media empire to take on Fox News. He plans to wreck Fox, no doubt about it, says a source. So there's this idea, not only does he want to have his own media empire, but he specifically wants to do it to destroy Fox. Fox News didn't give him what he wanted. Over the course of his presidency, they veered away from being Trumpists, and as a result, he's now out to get it. I don't think that's the main reason for his wanting to do a new digital media empire, but it's always fun to have opponents. He's doing it to destroy them. He plans to wreck Fox. I want to talk about Obama's book. There's an excerpt of it in the Atlantic. But first, let me just say, Trump did a lot of tweeting this morning. I said, here's the title of my post, "With Veterans Day Accomplished, Trump launches into a hot morning of tweeting." So I just noticed there was a lot of tweeting today. There couldn't be that much yesterday because it was a solemn day. It was Veterans Day. You might have seen the video of Trump and Melania going to I guess it must have been the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier or some somber place of that sort where he was putting a wreath. Some people noticed. I noticed this on my own, but I also saw an article about it that he was swaying, that he seemed to have trouble standing planted upright during the ceremony, but that his body swayed. You know, I used to notice that Tim Russert did that. Remember Tim Russert on Meet the Press? Back in the old days when Meet the Press was great. Meet the Press, Tim Russert had a way of just swaying in his chair. I thought he looked like he was some kind of a balloon, sort of swaying. So there was I consider the effect sort of a Tim Russert effect. Maybe it's something that a large, sort of bloated man might take on this quality. But of course, since it's Trump, people want to ascribe some sort of insanity to the effect. But I associate it with Tim Russert. And he was not insane, though he did one day at the office drop dead, as they say. I hope Trump is doing well. Maybe he still has some remnants of the old coronavirus. So I just copied down the last 14 hours. It was 14 back then. I guess that was at 8:27, and now it's much later. So let's say the last 24 hours of Trump's tweets after he got through the solemnities of Veterans Day. And I'm doing them in reverse chronological order. So he has this in quotes, and I don't know who he's quoting. Okay, I've seen enough. What's going to happen to these guys? McCabe, Comey, and the gang of treasonous thugs. And Senator John Kennedy, and then he addresses it to Senator John Kennedy, Maria Bartiromo, the Justice Department. And by they, he means McCabe, Comey, and the gang of treasonous thugs, not Kennedy and Bartiromo. They and many others got caught. Do something. And I don't know who he's quoting. Maybe he's just saying that. Okay, I've seen enough. I don't know. It's hard to keep up with this, the way things are done in a clipped style in Twitter. What is he even saying? The next one is from 200,000 votes to less than 10,000 votes. If we can audit the total votes cast, we will easily win Arizona also. And that's a comment on an Arizona Central Politics story that says Biden's lead in Arizona keeps shrinking, but not enough for Trump to overtake him. And then he's got a comment on a story that is West Virginia's Governor Jim Justice refused to acknowledge that Joe Biden won the presidential election. And he says, Big Jim is the greatest. And then he's commenting on an AP story, Donald Trump wins Alaska. He says, it took long enough. What is taking North Carolina so long? Are they looking for more ballots to fix that one also? Now with a recount, we will win Georgia also. Pennsylvania and Michigan wouldn't let our poll watchers and observers into the counting rooms. Illegal. And then there's a comment on a tweet that reads, what do we know about Dominion? And he said, it attempted to alter our election and got caught? Question mark. And I said, I don't know what that means. I didn't know what Dominion was. I had to go look it up. I looked for an answer to my question about Dominion and think it's a voting machine company. Gateway pundit, Trump, commenting on Trump's tweet, says, we've reported there were numerous instances in this election where votes were switched from President Trump to Joe Biden in states predominantly using Dominion voting machines. Tonight, the president responded that the Dominion voting systems were involved in election fraud. And they got caught. Did they get caught? I don't know. If I go over to Trump's Twitter feed now, something that came in after I put that post up, it says, and this is in all caps, report. And I think, I don't know where the report is, but it says report. And so it's in quotes. So I guess he's quoting something. Maybe OANN or Channel Rian. I don't know. He's tweeting this at them. So I don't know where the quote is from, but it says, in quotes and in caps, report, Dominion deleted 2.4 million Trump votes nationwide. Data analysis. Who's doing this data analysis? Data analysis finds 221,000 Pennsylvania votes switched from President Trump to Biden. 941,000 Trump votes deleted. States using Dominion voting systems switched 435 votes from Trump to Biden. I don't know. That's what it says. Well, back to the post. That came in after I put the post up. But he also has a comment on his own post from the 7th. He puts his own post from the 7th up, and that post said the observers were not allowed to go into the counting rooms. I won the election, got 71 million legal votes. Bad things happened which our observers were not allowed to see. Never happened before. Millions of mail-in ballots were sent to people who never asked for them. And the post today, upon retweeting that, is now 73 million legal votes. And then the next thing I'm seeing is nobody wants to report that Pennsylvania and Michigan didn't allow our poll watchers and or vote observers to watch or observe. This is responsible for hundreds of thousands of votes that should not be allowed to count. Therefore, I easily win both states, report the news. And I am pleased to announce that I've given my full support and endorsement to Ronna McDaniel to continue heading the Republican National Committee. With 72 million votes, we received more votes than any sitting president in U.S. history, and we will win. And finally, everyone is asking why the recent presidential polls were so inaccurate when it came to me, because they are fake, just like much of the lamestream media. And there's also a whole lot of retweeting over there. So he's really going very big and stirring up beliefs among his supporters, at least, I think. Some people are letting go of this, but many supporters, including many of my commenters, are very involved in this idea that there's a massive vote fraud and that Trump has the evidence. And they're getting exercised at me for not knowing more about it. And if you don't know what Dominion is, you must not have even looked at the comments of your various election threads for nearly a week. It's probably been 30% of our discussion. And I said down in the comments, I'm skipping a lot on this subject for sure. If I knew the word dominion, I forgot it. These assumptions that there must be a fraud. You got to show me. I said this down in the comments. If there's a fraud, show me the evidence. Don't just show me tweets from Trump where he's saying that there's analysis that shows this or that. What analysis? Who did it? Make it look like real evidence such that you could convince a court with it. Don't just rant. It looks like ranting, especially when you put it in all caps. It makes it seem like you've lost your mind. So I think it's really unfortunate. And either he's going to make a sound argument that people could listen to and that could work in court, or he's just given up on all of that and he's just on a rampage, acting like he's going to do, rallying his supporters after he leaves the presidency. And of course, I do think he will leave. But now I think back to some of these people who say, what if Trump won't leave? I always thought those people were being hysterical. But, you know, Trump does not try to create a sane atmosphere around himself. He's trying to make people feel anxious, right? His opponents have tried to make us feel anxious for 4 years. So I have some sympathy for him, even though I feel like an innocent bystander. Most of us are innocent bystanders. We would like to have some solidity and calm. And solidity and calm that doesn't just cover up all the things that are wrong. Let's see. Are we up? Are we down to the ones that are all sort of artistic? Well, let me talk, as long as we're talking about craziness, let me quote from Nick Bilton's article in Vanity Fair. This is a post that went up last night. And the article in Vanity Fair. So this is from the Vanity Fair article, which is titled Elon Musk's Totally Awful, Batshit Crazy, Completely Bonkers Most Excellent Year. In 2020, the COVID-doubting, media-hating, Twitter-holic CEO became the third richest man alive. SpaceX launched 2 astronauts into orbit, and Tesla became the most valuable car company on the planet, inside the mind of Silicon Valley's most vainglorious villain. And I quoted someone who's just unnamed in the article, but I thought this was an interesting quote. This person seems to know Elon Musk. He says, there's a high level of degenerate behavior with Elon. There's a paranoia. Are you with me or against me? I genuinely want to leave the room sometimes when he walks in. All of these guys, I've spent time with them, Musk, Zuck, all of them. They all exhibit tendencies of total and complete pathological sociopathy. They don't, at their core, give a flying fuck about you or me as individuals, close quote. And that's reminds me of the way they talk about Trump, you know, people ascribing a mental disease to someone who's a very high achiever and an unusual person, with it's a sociopathy or sociopathy, which is the better pronunciation. I'm not even sure. Anyway, Musk has a plan, this is me, a plan to colonize Mars to, quote, save humanity, given that we will likely destroy Earth through climate change or artificial intelligence or some other cataclysmically awful human-inspired event, close quote. Musk thinks he can get 1 million people living on Mars by 2050. I don't know if how many of them are going to be born there and how many of them are going to be moved in rocket ships. Personally, I don't believe it, and I don't see how Mars can be made more livable than Earth within that time frame. The idea that Earth is so ruined compared to Mars, which would have to start from nothing. I don't know how that could possibly work, how the people would be happy, what they would do if they were not happy there, and what kinds of life they would have, what kinds of government they would have. I guess they would just have Elon Musk as their dictator, but I'll bet he doesn't go. Bilton, the author of the Vanity Fair piece, envisions disaster because, quote, Musk will be there too. Oh, apparently he won't be there. Okay. Musk will be there too, and he will bring his extremes with him. If Twitter works on the red planet, Musk will still be blocking people who don't agree with him. I mean, that close quote, I think Nick Bilton is sort of being funny there, but who really believes this life on Mars is going to happen? Well, apparently Musk believes it, and so he has a visionary quality that's beyond what we can do with our tiny little minds. Well, so much for mental disease. Let's go to the physical disease, coronavirus. I'm seeing in Washington Post, quote, a record-breaking surge in U.S. coronavirus cases is being driven to a significant degree by casual occasions that may feel deceptively safe. Dinner parties, game nights, sleepovers, and carpools. Many earlier coronavirus clusters were linked to nursing homes and crowded nightclubs, but public health officials nationwide say case investigations are increasingly leading them to small, private social gatherings. This behind-doors transmission trend reflects pandemic fatigue and widening social bubbles, experts say, and is particularly insidious because it is so difficult to police and likely to increase as temperatures drop and holidays approach. Close quote. And I just repeated the phrase, it is so difficult to police. It's so difficult to police the inside of people's homes. I mean, that's the problem. You're doing things in your home, in private, and it's small, but they need to get in. Now, if they really wanted to surveil that, I think that they could just look at the data that the phone companies have. Don't the phone providers, the service providers, don't they know where everybody is? Couldn't they find people converging in even the smallest clusters? Go start busting those. People are doing something wrong. They could police it if they wanted to, but boy, wouldn't you be outraged if they came to break up your Thanksgiving dinner because you went beyond your designated bubble size? Now, from the comments over at the Washington Post, I found something that I didn't look that closely, but I didn't see that people were concerned about the government's interest in getting inside your personal home, but going in the other direction, this idea of that people are bad to be doing social gatherings like this, thinking that it doesn't apply to them. Here's one of the comments over there that I thought was interesting. Quote, here in rural Indiana, the mentality seems to be that as long as you know the people you are with, you don't have to worry. Doesn't matter that your friends or relatives could have picked up COVID from someone else. It's fine. A relative of mine has been in the hospital with a COVID infection that's been traced to the baby shower for her daughter-in-law. I'm sure they were all nice people, close quote. Yeah, I mean, it does point up something that there are a lot of people who think because they're the good people, they're not doing anything wrong, and people tend to flatter themselves and think that they're nice people. How could the rules apply to me or the people I know that my people are? Or what? Disease-free? Now, let's see. I'm down to pretty much the aesthetic ones and the thing about Barack Obama's book. So let's go to the aesthetic things. First is a woman who is living every day like it's 1958. This mostly has to do with her makeup, hairstyle, clothing, and also the interior decoration of her house, which her husband shares and her son shares. We're told the son is able to do his room his own way, but everything else is in this 50s style. It's not just 50s, it's specifically 1958. So I put that up in part because I thought maybe everybody would like to think about if you had to pick a year and live, not the current year. Well, nobody likes 2020 anyway, so good time to pick another year. But thinking about the styles, the way things looked, the way you would look, she was drawn to 1958 because she liked the way her grandmother looked in old photographs and video, I guess. They had video then. I have video of myself from the 50s. It's silent film. But it's quite interesting, and actually the adults look like they're having a lot of fun. So to me, if I had to pick a year for styling myself, it would probably be 1966. 1966, before it got too hippie and was mostly mod. So everything looked very modern, clean. Then a few years later, it got a little messier, more paisley and flowered patterns and scarves and long this and that. But I think right in the middle of the 60s was quite nice, quite idealistically modern and youthful. Although I'm very old now, I'm almost 70, but why not? Why not wear my Courrèges and Marie Quant outfits? You can find them. I could probably find them on eBay. Maybe I should do this. If only I'd kept all the things that I had. I had lots of great stuff, even though I had almost no money to spend on clothes. I managed to, managed to have some 60s style back then when I was 15, I would say, 15 in 1966. I'd go back to that. Now, speaking of styles, there's this Soviet portable radio that's quite interesting. There's a Twitter feed, Soviet Visuals, that has some interesting stuff. And we see the Nevsky 401 Soviet portable radio from 1987. It's hard to believe this was 1987. You might look at it and think it was more 1967. But what's so distinctive about it is that the dial is squared off. You know, the very thing that you would think would need to be round, they've made it into a square. I said, what's so amusing about this design is the commitment to rectangles, where curves make so much more sense. Or is that just my Western point of view? If the radio is rectangular, they seem to have thought, then the dial should be rectangular and the knob should be rectangular. If you begin with something rectangular, and you're not going to have an oval-shaped radio, then you ought to square off everything else, no matter how natural the curve seems to be. It's the opposite of form follows function. It's form follows form. Now we also see an art restoration where you remember the so-called Monkey Christ, where a woman, I forget the name of the city, had done a restoration of a painting of Jesus Christ and ended up making him look like a monkey with a very distinctive, all the detail that looked pretty realistic in the original. Ended up being all smeared out and looked like a pretty childish attempt at painting. And the mouth is all screwed up. The mouth kind of, to me, looks like a sucker on a fish, or the kind of mouth that's put on an inflatable sex doll. That's not appropriate, especially for Jesus. But in any case, we see that. We remember that, and we see there's a new thing. This one was actually a sculpture part of a building, a figure on a building, a defaced Spanish statue, the latest victim of botched restoration. Conservation professionals have questioned why Spain's heritage is continually handed over to those with no formal training. And it's just ludicrous what they've done to this statue. I mean, someone must have gotten up there with a chisel. Or at least a rasp. I'm assuming this is marble, but it's possible that it's plaster or something more scrapable, more easily scrapable. But they've ended up moving the eyes into completely different positions. And in fact, it looks so much like the Monkey Christ, it's hard to believe that starting with the face tipped over to one side, it's now tipping the opposite way with the eyes in the position as if the head were tipped the other way, and the mouth has that similar sort of a sucker shape. And I said, at least in art restoration, you can see what's gone wrong when things have been handed over to people who don't know what they're doing. They have no way to cover up what they've done wrong. Oh, they've messed it up. They see that they're not good, but they went ahead and did it, and they've messed up a work of art, and everyone can see it. I said, if I wanted to create a conspiracy theory, I would say there's a secret sect that worships a god that looks like that, one eye up, the other eye down, mouth like a sucker or sex doll. Another conspiracy theory that I thought of that I put in the comments is that it was done on purpose to attract tourists to the town, because that worked in the Monkey Christ case by accident. So why not try it again? Just because you have to sacrifice a seemingly worthy item of art, it's not that important of a piece of art. They may need the money. Maybe that's how you get tourists to come to your town, to point at that statue and laugh. Oh, the stupid people of this Spanish town. Palencia. Now, the other art post is another thing about what I was talking about yesterday, this Mary Wollstonecraft monument in London. You remember I talked about it in the podcast yesterday, and the new post has a link to the old post where I already talked about it, but it is a tribute to the feminist from the early 19th century, Mary Wollstonecraft. And it involves a sort of elaborate wave with a figure of a woman, a naked woman, nude woman at the top of it. And I'm reading in New York Magazine about it, an article called The Mary Wollstonecraft Monument in London is Bad Kitsch Feminism by Jerry Saltz. And Saltz called the sculpture solemn, shallow, feeble-minded, and homely. And, quote, a whirl of metal with a naked genie popping out of the top, strangely and inappropriately ejaculatory. So now we're imagining the lower part of the statue, which is sort of a white wave, blobby shape, as being the male ejaculate. And then the woman is in that, well, you know, giving birth. The male gives birth in this, as if the woman is a sperm or something. I don't know. Anyway, that was a good observation by Saltz. I had thought that myself, but declined to actually write it out. Not because I'm too shy about that, but just because I had other things to say. But I'm glad to quote that from Saltz. But the main part of the Saltz article that I wanted to quote was more generally about British art. I mean, the artist of this particular sculpture, Maggie Hambling, as I said yesterday, I'd never even heard of her. So British artists, maybe there's a problem with them. Maybe British art isn't that good. And so Saltz said, quote, shall I be mean about British art? Okay, realism and literature haunts almost all British art. I surmise that the capacious feel for language, narrative, and drama that seems to be inculcated in the British brain has caused a lot of British art to fall into clever commentary, agitprop, or academicism, or to be pulled back into realism. Great Britain is a primarily literary art. This doesn't work well visually. I further surmise that abstraction is not foremost in the British mind. So much for my silly xenophobia. The real answer for why most public sculpture is bad and why this keeps happening with art, much architecture, and too many governments is bureaucracy and populism and the rule of the common denominator, a need to not offend, to please, to be liked, at least by the people making the choice, to be popular and not to change. It defaults to the traditional values of whatever white hegemony dominated the culture 150 years ago, at the apex of American and European colonialism. When it comes to public sculpture, this usually means hackneyed figurative art that claims to signify or represent an idea or person, but really only represents lazy and regressive ideas, close quote. So now I was saying the other day that I had a problem with the public art of the last 50 years. I was thinking that the more traditional art that just realistically depicted heroes, you know, generals on their horses and the figure of liberty, you know, the kinds of statues that have been pulled down recently in the Black Lives Matter riots, I thought that those were what was old and traditional, and the more recent stuff was bad in a different way, bad because it was trying to be abstract. But Saltz is trying to say that public sculpture is bad because it is not abstract. I see a lot of abstract sculpture around here in Madison, Wisconsin. I've seen it in New York. I worked near the famous Tilted Art sculpture that was so hated by the people. And I just think terrible junk is put up and clutters the public space. To me, I think a big part of the problem is just a legal requirement that money be spent on public art, that part of building a public a commercial building is to take on the legal requirement that you have to put some money into art. And there are artists, I guess, who exist to provide this artwork. I just don't think it's expressive of anything individual from the artist. And yet it's not really expressive of the government's values either. It's just in this limbo of not meaning anything at all other than that money must be spent. And so people need to be available to take that money and to provide an object in response. And it's just no wonder that it's horrible junk. I just wish they wouldn't put anything there. Just don't put anything. Plant trees, why don't you? Plant trees, or why not just put rocks from nature? Although here in Madison, Wisconsin, we have a dispute over literally a rock, a big rock that was put in place up on the hill. And it's got a plaque on it honoring a particular professor. But because the rock long ago was called, not officially, but just by called by some people, maybe only called by somebody one time, a racially slurred word, you know, blank, head, the N-word and then head. Because of that, even though it was 100 years ago, people want to remove the rock. And it's just a rock. It's just a rock, and it's never been called officially by this nickname or that might have been current on campus 100 years ago. But we don't even know that much of anybody ever said it. But to be mad at a rock, and it's a cool-looking rock. Obviously, it's a giant boulder that they took the trouble to move to the top of a hill, you know, like Sisyphus pushing it up the hill. But, you know, you got to get mad at something, so why not at a rock? A rock. Why not at... I would prefer to get mad at a sculpture that a particular human being actually made and that particular human beings chose as this is what we want and spent tax money on. That is more kind of outrageous, don't you think? It's specific. But sculpture, it just can't be done right anymore, can it? So we've got one thing left, and that's Barack Obama, the long-distant president. He's on the horizon, and he's back with a book. His memoir is going to be published in two parts, and the first part is about to come out. It's called A Promised Land. And an excerpt from it is in The Atlantic right now. And the title of the excerpt is, "I'm not yet ready to abandon the possibility of America." And I titled the post, "Make America Possible Again." You know, a little play on Make America Great Again, Make America Possible Again. It was once possible. So here's the voice of Obama. "What can I say?" Wait, I did it wrong. I'm off to a bad start. Quote, What I can say for certain is that I'm not yet ready to abandon the possibility of America, not just for the sake of future generations of Americans, but for all of humankind. I'm convinced that the pandemic we're currently living through is both a manifestation of and a mere interruption in the relentless march toward an interconnected world, one in which peoples and cultures can't help but collide. Our divisions run deep. Our challenges are daunting. If I remain hopeful about the future, it's in large part because I've learned to place my faith in my fellow citizens, especially those of the next generation, whose conviction in the equal worth of all people seems to come as second nature, and who insist on making real those principles that their parents and teachers told them were true, but that they perhaps never fully believed themselves. More than anyone else, my book is for those young people. an invitation to once again remake the world and to bring about, through hard work, determination, and a big dose of imagination, an America that finally aligns with all that is best in us. And I said, in this rhetoric, America is something that has never existed in reality, only as a set of ideals. The America of Trump's Make America Great Again was not only never great in the past, it was never even America. At some point in the future, the dream of America may come true. Obama has considered abandoning the hope that America will someday come into existence, but he's holding off. He's putting his faith in the people, especially the next generation, which might be the millennials, but could be Gen Z. And don't forget the babies, the alphas, and what they'll be thinking, seemingly second nature after 10 or 15 years of whatever the Gen X and the millennials inflict upon us. Somehow, something known as the best in us, be best, will align with Mars, and peace will guide the planets, and love will steer the stars. And peace will guide the planets. That's first. I'm easing into the first line, first verse of Hair's great opening song, Aquarius. That's what it sounds like to me, this idea of coming into alignment. America, so there's the best in us, and then America needs to come into alignment with that. So America could exist. The possibility of America is there. It's if the best in us, especially the next generation or generations, if what's inside them, if they work, they can remake the world, and then they can bring this thing that is not yet America into alignment with what's best in them. And then America could come into existence at last. It's very conceptualized. It's very cerebral. So some people would say, well, that's what I like about Barack Obama. He's so smart. He's so eloquent. He's so different from Trump. Trump would never say something like that. Trump just says, make America great again. He's saying, he isn't even quibbling with that in the normal way of saying, well, was America ever great? It had slavery and it did this and Jim Crow. And so it was never great to say, make America great again. Just doesn't even, no, it's not that quibble. He's saying America is an idea that's out there, or it's in the hearts. America is in the hearts of the people, or the minds, the dreams. It's inside us. Or maybe not us, but those, we may have told them things were true and but perhaps never fully believed it ourselves, right? Did you see that? If I remain hopeful about the future, it's in large part because I've learned to place my faith in my fellow citizens, especially those of the next generation, whose conviction in the equal worth of all people seems to come as second nature, and who insist on making real those principles that their parents and teachers told them were true, but that they perhaps never fully believed themselves. That would be an interesting sentence to diagram. So you have the parents and teachers, you have the older generation who told the younger ones something was true, but maybe they didn't fully believe it. But the newer generation has had these principles inculcated into them by the older ones who didn't fully believe it. And so it's second nature to them. It's more completely internalized in the younger people. And they insist on making it real. So it's not enough for the younger ones to just say that it's true and partly believe it. Nor is it enough to simply, so it's just second nature to them. They're not struggling with whether they believe it or not anymore. They've moved on to insisting on making it real. So these principles that they learned from the older generation, that they internalized completely and made second nature, they then moved on to insisting on making it real. So this idea of America is now on track to come true because the younger people insist on making it true. So they have something inside them that they believe second nature and insist on making true. And he is inviting these people to bring about, through hard work, determination, and a big dose of imagination, an America that finally aligns with what is best in us. So if that those beliefs, those principles that are internalized in the young, if those young people follow through on their insistence on making it real, then what we have in reality will finally align with this principle that is held inside. So you have to get the outward America to align with the inward America, the idea of America. So real and abstract. I wonder what the Atlantic writer, what was his name, Jerry Saltz, was that right? The New York Magazine writer about the British sculpture, he had a problem with the way the Brits were so literary. They were so in the realm of ideas that they weren't good at making something visual. I wonder if there's a similar idea that you could think of with respect to Americans with their principles of justice and equality and freedom and all of these things that we're so into as literary, maybe you would say, ideas. Can we actually make them real? Will we be any good at making them real? Or will there be some kind of clunky failure as we try to realize things that originate in this dream form? I don't know if those two things are the same, trying to have principles and making a society and a government that that aligns with those principles, and having literary ideas like the rights of women, and then trying to make a sculpture about it and ending up with a little well-formed nude lady popping out of the top of a massive ejaculate. Think about that. That has nothing to do with America, or does it? It was supposed to represent the rights of women. You're trying to make something in the outward world that corresponds to the inward idea. So the Maggie Hambling sculpture, very similar to the Obama idea of what America needs to be. But Obama is not sculpting America. Obama is just continuing to add to the literary mass, the literary ideas, but he's expressing this hope that the young people will really make it happen in real life. But what exactly is it that he's talking about? What is it that parents and teachers taught them were true and that they now believe second nature? Is it this wokeism that is sort of problematic, or is it some kind of true equality and freedom? Maybe I need to buy the book to try to figure that out, but I'm not a fan of Obama's prose. Did you see the, I didn't blog this, but I could easily come up with it. There's a New York Times book review of Obama's A Promised Land. And this is by Chima Manda Ngozi Adichie. Am I supposed to know who she is? Maybe she's just one of their regular reviewers. She's the author of the novels Purple Hibiscus, Half a Yellow Sun, and Americana. And she's written a short story collection, The Thing Around Your Neck. Okay, so she's a novelist. And here's how her review of Obama's memoir begins. And I'm not kidding. Barack Obama is as fine a writer as they come. Now, no, I can't believe that. I can't believe that. But I find his writing kind of hard to take. It's not my favorite type of writing at all, but maybe I should buy that book and just use it to find things to blog. Is that wrong?